listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor Portland Folk Music Society concerts. The spring series concludes on Saturday, June 11th with Hank Kramer, an old-fashioned folk singer from the American West. Hank Kramer can play and sing more than 1,000 modern and traditional songs. The Portland Folk Music Concerts are at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-charge bookkeeper. Do you have accounting and administrative experience? Do you enjoy working in a highly collaborative team environment? Are you looking for a workplace with a mission? Or do you know someone who is? Go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the full-charge bookkeeper and the qualifications we are looking for. To apply, please email your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org by Sunday, June 12th at midnight. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. KBOO's financial health is our focus. Help us foster it.
Hello and welcome to The Bike Show. My name is Alon Rab and I will be joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. In the first half of the show, Nedra will speak with Karim Kamara of Sierra Leone, head of the Tour de l'Unsar race and celebration, and chair of the Village Bicycle Project in his country. In the second half of the show, we will hear talks by Mike Cobb and Cameron Bennett given at the recent Oregon Active Transportation Summit conference organized by the Street Trust. Mike Cobb will speak about the disaster relief trials, and Cameron Bennett will speak about e-bikes. As summer is just around the bend, it is also time for the yearly Pedalpalooza Bike Summer, a wonderful celebration of bicycle culture. The event, held since 2002, includes dozens of rides and is one of the best ways I know to counter despair and gloom while having fun. You're listening to The Bike Show. Co-host Nedra Deadweiler traveled recently to Sierra Leone, where she participated in the Tour de l'Unsar race celebration. She will be speaking with Karim Kamara, CEO of the race, who is also Sierra Leone's manager for the Village Bicycle Project, which aims to empower communities in Ghana and Sierra Leone by strengthening bicycle culture. The organization subsidizes bicycle with maintenance training and provides equipment and tools.
My name is Nedra Deadweiler, and we're here talking with Karim Kamara, the CEO of the Tour de l'Unsar, and just having a little bit of a catch-up chat post-tour. My experience with coming to the tour, one, coming to Sierra Leone, I learned so much about Sierra Leone that I did not know before. The history and just the significance to West Africa, having the first university in West Africa, really being the height of tourism in West Africa, and just all the amount of trade that takes place there. And the landscape and the architecture and agriculture, and also just the cultural continuity between the southern U.S. I am in Georgia, so I could see a lot of same culture between Black people here and the Black people in Sierra Leone. So that was very much heartwarming. And then to experience cycling, the professionals, the people who were racing, the men, women, and young people that were racing was epic. But then also just seeing regular people cycling as well for exercise or even getting around. It was amazing that everybody had a place. I felt the traffic flow together. We didn't have to fight for position on the street. Will you tell who you are and how this project became your purpose?
Well, from my own original perspective, it's just like it started from nothing to something. So at first, when I first started fixing bicycles, getting involved, thinking about bicycle and cycling, it's like I think I'm getting killed. And from the kill, I developed the passion. From the passion, okay, I thought it that I have developed a career through the work that I'm doing in cycling, and I should also help other people to achieve that. So it came from my heart, which is a passion, and to see that you promote people through cycling, then to see that you bring people across the world like you came to Sierra Leone all the way from the United States to attend the Tour de Lusa, and to see that more people come next time to attend the Tour de Lusa, or for us to meet in one platform where we all can have fun, which is like the Tour de Lusa. So it's all started with great passion, and now I'm helping to promote other people and to make other people get experience in exploring Sierra Leone and Sierra Leone at large through cycling.
I think there's a lot that is possible. For the people that I have just briefly shared my experience, there's a lot of curiosity because most people just remember the conflict, the civil war that happened. Being able to hear about the agriculture, the culture, people, what the terrain, the landscape looks like, and that there's this race, this three-day race. People want to understand how cycling is growing and blossoming across the continent. The difference between what it is to cycle in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia, Africa, how else are the cyclists there participating on this global stage of cycling?
My job here, or like, my dream is coming true by supporting, promoting young people through my initiative. So seeing young people out there, like 2 weeks back they were in Ghana, and now they got the opportunity to go to South Korea. This is how. So it is like my dream is coming true, and we never expected this, but it is something that I have been working on. To see that I create this kind of opportunity, to see that people get the awareness of what we are doing. Because just as you know, Sierra Leone has gone through the civil war and through the Ebola and now the COVID-19 pandemic. So since then, people know nothing about Sierra Leone. So I just think like cycling and of course, Tour de Lusa and with all the other side projects that I'm doing can make me raise the awareness people to know about CNU. For example, and Tour de Lusa, it has given young people the opportunity, even you, the opportunity to come to CNU and experience how life operates here. I know your small time of visiting here, you have experienced a lot, and you have experienced already. So we are like with some of these young boys also can get their own experience by exploring the Western countries and countries in Africa. So this is like a dream for me. And with other projects, like just for people to know about Sierra Leone, and with Village Bicycle Project, Village Bicycle Project is the umbrella of the whole Tour de Lusa and all the other projects that I'm doing. So because I collect used bikes from the United States, ship them to Sierra Leone, then distribute them to school-going children that walk 6 to 7 miles every day. So with that, it does not only stop here. I thought that Sierra Leonean and the whole of Africa and the whole world, we need jobs. And I create job and happiness for people. So I think cycling and agriculture, including education, can also promote people, then give them jobs, create empowerment for them. So with that, I like building bicycle project with the bikes we always supply. And I see young people always branded in the street, but I get a dream to see that we can promote them school cycle. We can create the environment for them. We can give them the experience. We can connect the world into this one platform, which is cycling. So that is how all came about.
What you've just described is this intersectional project through this, through the tool of cycling. The bicycle is a tool for revolution, for liberation, for health and wellness, so many things. And talking about education, talking about job creation, talking about the health, healthy body, healthy mind, and also the community that comes from the project of the Village Bicycle. You're just referring to the Village Bicycle Project. Many children have to travel distances in order to go to school, so having a reliable bicycle is important. Are people able to donate bicycles from here? If so, how can they get bicycles to you?
For sure, you can donate your bicycle if you're in the U.S. You can donate your bicycle at Walking Bike Chicago and Walking Bike Foundation in Chicago, or you can send it directly to Village Bicycle Project in Seattle, or you can send your bicycle to Mike Bikes Foundation in California, or you can send it to Bikes for the World at Washington, D.C. So, like, yeah, and these are all partners I work with to ship bikes in Sweden. Bikes, you know, bicycle changes lives, and life, it makes life happy through cycling. It makes you meet different people. So, your bicycle that you're going to donate, we put smile on people's face, and we make them be happy. We make them acquire education. We make them access their farm. Make them to see different environments across their country and across the world.
That's a remarkable opportunity and also a remarkable service. Would it be helpful to have additional partners for this project?
Sure. We want partners. As you see, you have been here. 85% of the racers of this year are local racers. And all the bikes they are donated bikes from the United States and Europe. So we simply mean your old bike can create happiness. Your old bike can connect people across the world. Your old bike can make someone acquire education. So your old bike can empower someone as well and make someone explore around the world. Because one bicycle can support 10 people here in their family. But one bicycle one person can use it to go to the market, buy food for their family, they cook, they eat, and like all of the family can eat through the one bicycle. So it creates that kind of happiness. So with that, like, we are looking forward to whatever opportunity whatever community in the United States might want to offer to us.
You're listening to The Bike Show. Co-host Nedra Deadweiler traveled recently to Sierra Leone, where she participated in the Tour de l'Unsar race celebration. Her guest is Karim Kamara, CEO of the race, who is also Sierra Leone's manager for the Village Bicycle Project, which aims to empower communities in Ghana and Sierra Leone by strengthening bicycle culture. The organization subsidizes bicycle with maintenance training and provides equipment and tools.
Do the bikes need to be in a particular condition?
Specifically, we are looking for mountain bikes, kids bikes, and road bikes. That mountain bikes, if you had hybrid, we're looking for mountain bikes that are 26 inches, 29 inches mountain bikes and road racing bikes. And also we are taking kids bikes like 24 inches, 20 and 16 inches. And we take like bicycle gears. As you've been here, all the gears racers are used, donated stuff from the United States and some parts of the world. So we take like used gears and helmets included in other equipment. We take components, tubes, tires, whatever spare parts that you have. And we even take clothing because many people don't have clothes here. So if you have clothes, you just keep them shoes, you just send them and we ship them to Sierra Leone. And people, that can change people's lives, can make people happy. Because, sincerely speaking, I know many people in Sierra Leone, it can take 3 years, they can't able to buy a $1 cloth. They can use one cloth for 5 years without able to buy another one. So, like, yeah, so your old cloth can change life, yeah. Your old cloth can make someone happy here.
Well, that sounds great. Thanks for sharing that. And I think there are probably people who will be reaching out to learn how they can organize a bike delivery to Sierra Leone. What are some other challenges that you would like support around overcoming?
Yes, definitely. So, very soon, let me just start to, as you do know, Sierra Leone has gone through the war, and Ebola, which takes out thousands of lives. And presently, we started an agricultural project with my new charity organization called receive.uk.org. You can check it out. So we are supporting over 6 communities in agriculture to produce different crops and rice, because people lack of food as well. There are people in Sierra Leone that can't make even $1 a day. But by we supporting them to create their own farm, to plant their own crops, and give them the opportunity to sell it in the market, they make some money. That is a hard thing as well. And the rest, they eat it with their family without getting swatted with hunger. Because hunger is another big challenge in Sierra Leone. But with Reseed, we thought it that we can support people to grow their own crops, and they can use it to feed their family, and even sell some to the market and pay for their kids to go to school. So with that, finally, we are supporting 6 communities. So if you are out there wanting to support a community for this whole project, and like $3,500 can support a community, build a whole farm that can help them to sell crops and provide food for themselves and able to support their kids to go to school. I get this understanding through my adventure cycling through different communities across the country. And whenever I travel to a particular community, people want to eat my food, they want me to share my food with them, of which sometimes it is not possible. And I see them got stranded because of hunger. So with that, like with the agricultural project, supports families and community in that great mood and happiness, and allow them to acquire a lifetime education and create happiness in them.
It's a 500-fold return on investment, because as you're saying, you're giving happiness, but this happiness is because the joy of cycling, the fact that they're able to grow crops and have delicious food, really creating a life, a sustainable life, something where communities are sustained, families are sustained, and they're also self-sufficient, which is almost imperative and the most important thing. If we're talking about cycling as a tool for liberation, your project really is expansive, because it's not just about a bike race. It's a bike race, but it's also about lifting up community and building people for the future. Cyclists that are out there. What is the age range from the youngest to the oldest cyclist?
I think from the youngest, we have from eight to 40, 45 to 60. So it's an inclusive project that encourages everyone. Even if you are not an active cyclist, you want to come and explore with the cross, with all the long side, we can come. If you are not a racer, you can come. And if you are an active cyclist or you have a cycling club, you can come and race in the Tour de Lusa. Because we, like you see, the boys are very passionate about racing. Even when they stop, they want to race and activate their speed to tell you that they can race and ride more than you. But just a platform to encourage everyone and to welcome everyone. So if you want to race, you can come and race. If you want to do an excursion to enjoy the beauty of Sierra Leone or to interact with so many people across Sierra Leone.
You're listening to The Bike Show. Co-host Nedra Deadweiler traveled recently to Sierra Leone, where she participated in the Tour de Lunsa race celebration. Her guest is Karim Kamara, CEO of The Race, who is also Sierra Leone's manager for the Village Bicycle Project, which aims to empower communities in Ghana and Sierra Leone by strengthening bicycle culture. The organization subsidizes bicycle with maintenance training and provides equipment and tools.
I know that you were in the process of planning the race for 2023. Can you give us a preview?
Yes, for sure. In 2023, we are looking at... In 2023, we are looking at April from the 26th to the 30th. And this is a massive package because, like, you just came here, like, you witnessed the tour for 3 days. Now we have added another 1 day to make it 5 days total. So it makes you have more time in the country and understand exactly what we are doing here. So with that, it gives everyone the opportunity to meet you and for you also to meet people.
Sounds like a great opportunity. And maybe it's an opportunity for partnerships to help develop programming during that time. Yeah?
Definitely so. So also, like, just to let you know, because I know I do really wanted to take you around bike shop and project, like the agricultural project, bike shop project that we support young cyclists here, just for them to be empowered. Because for example, like the GC winner of this year's tour is a winner of the Lone Star Cycling Team. But he received no payment on a monthly basis. So for me, as a CEO and founder of the Tour de Lonzar, I thought it'd be that something that can keep this boy happy is for him to print. Yes, it's for me to create a bike shop for him. So, like, yes, in 2018, I started out with the fastest female cyclist in Sierra Leone. We supported by Reseed in the UK. And with Reseed, we opened a bike shop for Aisata Sama Monde. This time we did not meet her because she's pregnant. But I think she really feels sad because she missed the opportunity on this year's tour. Like, Aisata is the first female mechanic in Sierra Leone, and of which she has been running her bike shop for the past 4 years. And she gets tools from us, trainings, and like everything. And in her community, Aisata makes cycling to be more popular here. Because whenever Aisata came to race in the Tour de Lonzar, her community will come to support her, because like she's the only hero in Makeni of which people know her for cycling. So with that, we did that for the same 2020 Tour de Lonzar winner. We opened a bike shop for him as well. He's very successful. He has been running his bike shop for the past 1 year now. And also, we did that for Ibrahim. He is a 2022 GC winner of the tour. And for us to create empowerment for him, and for us to keep his passion, we open a bike shop for him, where he has empowered other people. He has apprentices, he has other people that he's teaching how to fix bike. And he has cyclists, both male and female, that he is training to be cyclists. So if you want to support our bike shop project, please don't hesitate to contact us, because we are planning to open more bike shop for car mechanics and cyclists here across the country.
The Village Bicycle Project is a US-based organization, and please don't hesitate to contact them if you want to get involved in any one of these projects.
When we came into Lonzar, just the children, they're very much interested in cycling, in the cyclists, and had so much exuberance and were there to cheer on and celebrate. What other opportunities exist for children?
Cycling is the opportunity and for their future and for everything. And from cycling, we want to make them be empowered, have good health condition, and make them happy and make them explore around the world. And it is the biggest sport in Lonzar, and we want to make it more efficient to see that many young boys and girls always be happy and have the energy to cycle and have the energy to celebrate and dance like you were doing. It's not the only way, but the way. It's the way to live in power. It's the hope of the young boys and girls of Lonzar.
I noticed that there were projects around ecology, around to address deforestation. Would you say that cycling is an opportunity there to address climate change?
It's the biggest opportunity, and that is why we are requesting for more bikes. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, now our biggest target, we support school-going boys and school-going girls, speeders, farmers, and different kind of people, but more especially these that I have mentioned. If you're looking at our reason of supporting them, it's just because what we have is small, and those who need it are plenty. You know, for example, girls have been marginalized for them not to cycle, because people say if they cycle, they will lose their virginity. But me came as an example to say, no, it's wrong. A man can cycle, a woman can cycle. You can enjoy cycling through riding your bicycle. You can get good health. You can race and achieve what you want. Okay, you can use it to go to school, improve your grades, and like everything. And talking about climate change, is a massive problem in Sierra Leone because 90% of the cars that we use are used car. And with bicycle, I believe it can help protect people from climate change. And there is no way the government can at least stop it for now. But if we have more bikes to send in the city, in communities, in different cities across the country, at least it can help mitigate the problem of climate change. That is why we are asking if wherever you are, support with your bicycle or bicycle components, cycling gears, it's going to help make a change in Sierra Leone.
It's important to stand up and say, yeah, this is for everyone, and for everybody. Every person can get on a bike, no matter the age, no matter the gender expression. This is something for you. So that's great, remarkable.
We're here to encourage you to come down here, to come and see what we are doing, and to come and see how life is existing here, to come and see what is the difference between life in America and life in Sierra Leone. If $5 can change your life here.
Yeah.
In the United States, $5 is like nothing for people. So here, it is a massive something for people. Imagine I told you like $3,500 can support a community to do an agricultural project a year with visit, visit.uk, visit.uk.org. So with that, like, that is how life imagines. Many communities have over 500 people, but they can all come to one and make one farm, grow their own crops, decided whom and whom to send to school, decided to provide their own food and eat some of their crops and sell some in the market and make their life sustainable and happy. So with that, like, that is how life live here. And that is the job that I'm doing, of what I'm doing through cycling, through the Torilosa and Philip Bicycle Project in general, which is the main umbrella behind the whole thing.
Thank you so much for sharing with us today, Kareem.
You're listening to The Bike Show. Co-host Nedra Deadweiler traveled recently to Sierra Leone, where she participated in the Tour de l'Unsau race celebration. Her guest was Kareem Kamara, CEO of the race, who is also Sierra Leone's manager for the Village Bicycle Project, which aims to empower communities in Ghana and Sierra Leone by strengthening bicycle culture. The organization subsidizes bicycle with maintenance training and provides equipment and tools. If you would like to learn more about Kareem Kamara and the projects he is involved with, please go to lunsarcycling.com/home, and that is lunsarcycling.com/home. Also, the website of the Village Bicycle Project. And if you would like to write Kareem himself, you could write to stylishmankareem@gmail.com. That is stylishman, K-A-R-I-M, @gmail.com. We will take a short break, and when we come back, we will hear several talks given at the recent Oregon Active Transportation Summit, a yearly event organized by the Street Trust. Stay tuned.
Old pirates, Yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ship. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs.
Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs. All I ever had, redemption songs. These songs of freedom, songs of freedom.
And those were Johnny Cash and Joe Strummer singing Redemption Song. Every year, Portland Street Trust Organization holds the Oregon Active Transportation Summit. Next, we will hear parts of two talks given at the summit. First, we will hear from Mike Cobb, the Disaster Relief Trials, an annual event in which cargo bikes compete to deliver supplies and help during a disaster. And after Mike Cobb, we will hear from a talk by Cameron Bennett, Portland State University, about his research on e-bikes and incentives that might increase their appeal.
My name is Mike Cobb, and I help to design and develop disaster relief trials, which is a disaster preparedness event in the form of a cargo bike competition, which displays the relevance of cargo bikes to citizen preparedness. And this was all inspired by the earthquake in Haiti in 2010 and the frustration generated from watching an inadequate relief response and understanding that because communication was so badly broken, proximal villages could not exchange information about needs and assets. Feeling frustrated from watching the really slow, protracted relief in Haiti in 2010, I tried to think of something that I could add to the tableau in disaster response to enable citizens, which FEMA says are the primary responders in major disasters, not professional responders. In fact, FEMA says that 95% of disaster victims are rescued or aided by helpful ad hoc neighbors. And so the disaster relief trials was developed as a response to Haiti to demonstrate what cargo bike enabled citizens could add to a citizen response. And this is just a reflection of really the essential utility of bikes that's been shown and highlighted and de-highlighted throughout history. Bikes have offered lots and lots of utility, and at least half of the patents in the patent office in the late 1800s. And you can bet there are a lot of load-carrying bikes that would have been pressed into service during natural disaster when other conveyances are disabled by broken roads, fuel shortages, and other disruptions in infrastructure. So, sadly, 316,000 ended up dying. Primary influences and then secondary and tertiary protracted relief injuries. Infrastructure was destroyed, didn't allow for automobile travel for months and months. And disease outbreak was one of the secondary elements that was enabled by a very slow relief response. And then in 2011 in Japan, obviously we had more inspiration for showing off cargo bike relevance to citizen-based disaster response. And this, in fact, inspired some cohorts at Tsukuba University in Tsukuba, Japan, to develop their own disaster relief trials using our model. And in fact, this year, June 11th, the Portland Disaster Relief Trials we'll host students and a professor from Tsukuba University. They're going to compete and help. So as I glossed over, the Disaster Relief Trials is an event that has two missions. We want to show the relevance of cargo bikes to disaster relief with a lot of flair and a lot of fun and with authenticity. And then as races, as competitions do, we want to stimulate the development of technique and equipment for the most effective versions of cargo bike-based relief. And and to even distill the mission, the double mission more, this is a cargo bike supply run in a simulated environment of infrastructure disruption. And so we developed a model that includes 12 essential elements, which allow any would-be organizer to develop their own disaster relief trials and adequately display the capabilities of a cargo bike. And I'm just going to run through those. The disaster relief trials is comprised of a checkpoint series that which have addresses that are given to riders 1 hour prior to the start of the event. And everything is contained by the checkpoint. And disaster relief trials events must have between 5 and 10 checkpoints. And so this is where the supply runners pick up relief supplies, authentic relief supplies, and encounter infrastructure disruption obstacles like broken terrain and barriers and a water feature. And so, as I said, at the checkpoints, cargo is picked up, and the full circuit, if you are in a category that is tasked with the full circuit, you will accumulate 50 kilograms of cargo, which is about 110 pounds of cargo. And a full circuit will take riders at least 3 hours, representing a realistic shift. Essential element number 4, the barrier that I mentioned, there must be a 1 meter barrier that riders encounter after accumulating at least half of their relief supply payload. There's a water feature, which is awfully fun and slightly dangerous and needs to be only 50 meters in length and 6 inches deep. And it just demonstrates that cargo bikes are good flood disaster responding tools within a scope, 6 inches being perhaps edge of the scope in a flood situation. Rough terrain feature, 400 meters in length, and it must make most riders dismount, demonstrating that a cargo bike is a good hand cart. Competition monitoring allows us to demonstrate meshing radio communication with a cargo bike supply runner mission, allows for monitoring of the riders, and this allows local emergency amateur radio operators to practice their craft. And the requirements are that at least two checkpoints be monitored by radio operators who will transmit participant information to the base, which is the start finish, where another amateur radio operator will provide a dispatch service, and a leaderboard will be populated with this real-time radio transmitted data or information. So that's competition monitoring, and allows for spectators at the base, which is the start finish area, to see what's happening in real time. So it's a self-navigated circuit of checkpoints, and riders are given a laminated map, which also has a manifest on it. The manifest listing the checkpoints and what's to be achieved at each checkpoint. The map has the checkpoints pinned and allows for a non-electronic navigation device navigation. Safety is super paramount in that it's an open course situation technically, and so traffic laws are obeyed at all times, and disqualification results if anybody violates any traffic law. The start is always a Le Mans start, meaning that the rider is separated from their vehicle, and they're required to do some sort of mission preparation, which declumps a 50-rider group, allows the entry of riders into the open streets to be strung out naturally. And there is a motor assist division allowed, and this year with the Oregon Bicycle Racing Association insurance, we're limiting the motor assist to 1,000-watt motors, which do not contribute after 20 miles an hour and which do not have a throttle function. And electronic navigation is allowed for the e-bike category if they can prove that off-grid charging, they have an off-grid charging system. And backing up to essential element number 11, the e-assist category allows for a 2-minute time bonus if you provide evidence of a off-grid battery charging system.
You are listening to The Bike Show. Mike Cobb of the Disaster Relief Trials is speaking about the annual event in which cargo bikes compete to deliver supplies and help during a disaster. The event will take place this year in Portland on June 11th at Cooley Park in Northeast Portland. The talk was recorded during the recent Oregon Active Transportation Summit organized by the Street Trust.
The transferability has been demonstrated over the years. Starting in 2013, it spread from Portland to Eugene, Victoria, Seattle, and Boulder. And 2014, 15, and 16 saw quite a few cities deploying disaster relief trials. Arlington in 2018 and 2019, Virginia, and Tsukuba, Japan, 2021. The participants only know what kind of cargo they're going to be accumulating 1 hour prior to the event, but it usually includes a lot of water, a lot of food, and building materials. And hopefully the building materials are really awkward. So please contact disasterrelieftrials at gmail.com to learn more. And please visit disasterrelieftrials.com to learn more.
And that was Mike Cobb of the Disaster Relief Trials talking about the annual event in which cargo bikes compete to deliver supplies and help during a disaster. Our final speaker today will be Cameron Bennett of Portland State University, and he will talk about his research on e-bikes and incentives that might increase their use.
And, you know, so we did a review of 13 popular brands here just to get a general idea of what the price of bikes looks like, or the price of these e-bikes looks like, for the models that we're typically going to see people pick up to use for their day-to-day activities. And generally what we're seeing is that prices range somewhere between $1,000 and $5,000 for those commuter and leisure styles, generally sitting right about $2,600. And then those cargo bikes are much, much more expensive, right? Sitting somewhere between $2,000 and like $9,000, you know, with a mean price somewhere around $5,000. So the e-bike market today is, like we heard in one of the presentations this morning, you know, there's something special going on in the market here. We saw, for that bike boom in 2020, we saw 122% increase in sales, and then another 53% increase above that between 2022 in 2021. At this point, we're seeing over 1 million units sold each year in the United States, which is pretty exciting. So really, really fast uptake of this technology today. And importantly, right, we're seeing that this is now a transition from what was before kind of a fringe technology or something just kind of fun to have to a legitimate mode that's really kind of enriching our transportation network, right? This is something that people are using in large scales to get around cities. So again, kind of here's the sales figures comparing the sales for conventional bicycles. So on the left, these are non-powered bicycles. We see that bike boom in 2020, you know, when the pandemic happened, people were looking for something to do outside and they bought a lot of bikes. But then the following year in 2021, sales have gone back down to historic levels, give or take. Whereas for e-bikes, right, we saw that bike boom in 2020 and they've sustained growth looking forward here. And then we see on that graph on the right as well, the breakdown by different categories of bicycle. So we see that a large portion of the market is that kind of transit or fitness style. So those kind of more leisure commuter bikes. And then that largest segment of the market there, the other bikes, I imagine is comprised of cargo bikes as well as bikes whose category wasn't captured at the point of purchase, you know, for the data that we were using here to estimate the market. So why e-bike purchase incentives? You know, the e-bikes offer a really, really great amount of accessibility for people. If you are in a hilly area or you like to dress nice for work and you don't want to get sweaty when you show up, the pedal assist allows for, you know, a whole large range of use cases, as well as, you know, the ability to haul more cargo, right? So that includes kids or groceries or whatever else you do in your day-to-day travel. And so they provide a really attractive alternative to vehicle travel for over these kind of middle distances, anything up to like 15 miles, right? You can do really effectively within an hour on an e-bike. And so municipalities that are interested in decreasing the vehicle miles traveled on their system or shifting people out of private automobiles, e-bike incentive programs are a really, really great way to invest a little bit of money to accomplish those goals. So we're seeing those emerge as a really popular technique. So kind of the questions for this work that we were looking at is how price could be used to bridge the chasm of the technology adoption curve for e-bikes. So we're starting to see the establishment of a really firm market here for e-bikes, but there's still plenty of room for growth, right? The sales figures for conventional bikes are still much, much higher than they are for e-bikes. And so we're trying to figure out how we can introduce e-bikes here as a more whole part of the market, you know, using that price as a mechanism to do so. And so when looking to answer that question, we were kind of curious what the current trends are in e-bike incentive programs in North America and what the best practices are for administering those programs. So for study methods here, we did a big policy scan of all the existing programs, you know, largely using Google Search and Google Alerts, and then pulling information from program web pages and application materials. We ran a series of interviews with some of the program managers, and then we've worked on a literature review for existing incentive philosophies to kind of develop some more best practice and some more ideas that may have not come up in that program review. So the results of that inventory, we found 75 programs, you know, looking to incentivize e-bikes in some way in the US and Canada. 38 of those are currently active. And then importantly, 13 of those are only in the proposal phase, right? So they've been floated in the legislature on some level, but not yet passed or implemented. And then the really important number here is that 37 of those programs that have been active or closed are cash subsidy programs. And those are what I'm going to focus on largely for the rest of the conversation here. And here's just a really quick map of the distribution of those programs. Largely, we're seeing that the existing programs today are focused, you know, really heavily in a couple of states. Right, in California and Colorado and in Vermont. But we're starting to see a spattering of others all around the continent here. But of course, right, still a huge opportunity for some geographic spread, right? We've got a big gap, you know, in Oregon and in Washington, you know, as well as through the whole middle of the country and in the South. So, you know, tons of opportunity for continued expansion of these ideas. We've made all of our data collection for this inventory scan publicly available, and I'll share a link for that at the end here. So I'm going to run through just a couple of statistics for those programs now, just to give you an idea of what's actually out there. So this is for all the programs, all the different mechanisms that we caught for incentivizing e-bikes. And largely, right, these were cash subsidies in some form, either through a post-purchase rebate or a point-of-sale discount. But there's a variety of other ways that e-bikes can be incentivized, right, either by handing them out for free or by providing a lending library, right, where you can borrow a bike for a week or two at a time to try it out, see if it works for your lifestyle. Among those post-purchase rebates and point-of-sale incentives, we were interested in how they established the amount of money that they were going to hand out. And largely, those were flat rate values, right? So no matter how much your bike cost, you were given a specified amount of money. However, there, you know, was a significant proportion of these programs that provided cash that was proportional to the purchase price of the bicycle, often with a cap on the highest applicable purchase price on the bike. And then the incentive amounts varied really greatly, right? Largest number of them ended up kind of in that $200 to $600 range. But we're starting to see more and more programs emerge at that really, really high dollar value range. I've included any low income options. So if there's preferential subsidies for people at qualifying income levels, I've included all those as separate programs for this graphic. So there's a little bit of an inflation on those higher values that may not be available to the general public, but that's shown in the lighter colors on the graphic. And then the ways that low income was defined for a lot of these programs varied. Largely, it seemed like the easiest way to go about this was by qualifying participants by their participation in any income qualified programs. So we're talking like SNAP or some sort of housing assistance program. But then the next easiest way would be to go by the federal poverty guidelines, which are published by the Department of Health and Human Services. And so we often saw low income qualified as a percentage of those federal poverty guidelines, typically at 200 or 400%. And then funding sources. So these are the folks that are running these programs. Largely it was power districts, right? And there's incentive for them to do so because by offsetting vehicle miles traveled, they can claim that they're performing some carbon offset, which of course gets them kickbacks at the end of the day. And then there's a number of nonprofits and advocacy groups, largely running smaller programs, but there's a number of larger programs being run by those groups as well.
You are listening to The Bike Show and a talk by Cameron Bennett of Portland State University about his research on e-bikes and incentives that might increase their use.
A lot of you have likely heard about the e-bike act that was floated by Blumenauer here, what, a little bit over a year ago now. At this point, that bill has been rolled into the Build Back Better Act. So its passing is kind of more contingent on the political bargaining that goes on here over the next little bit. But if that were to pass, right, we'd see a tax liability credit, which you could claim, you know, on your end of your taxes, set to 30% of the purchase price. However, that'll be capped at a $900 credit and capped at a maximum purchase price of $4,000 for the e-bike, which, if you remember our scan of e-bike prices, right, prices out most cargo bike models. So we think this is a huge oversight, you know, in the writing of this bill, but was likely just the result of some of the political bargaining that went on as they rolled this into the Build Back Better. And then equitable outcomes in these programs are generally pursued through income qualification. We saw about a quarter of the programs were fully income qualified. So in order to get any benefit, you had to meet that threshold. And then about 11% of the programs provided some additional benefits by meeting those low income thresholds. So for the rest of the discussion here, I'm gonna run through kind of our recommended program design following this framework here. And one of the outputs from this project is a white paper that we're hoping to have out here in the next couple of weeks that will go through all these points in a whole lot of detail. But for the rest of this presentation, I'm just gonna go ahead and discuss the best practice, you know, as we see it. So, you know, first step here is to define your guiding principles. And here it's really important that the goals of the program kind of reflect the provider's priorities and reflect the benefits that e-bikes can provide for a community. Right. And so that's going to vary largely by area. But, you know, the overarching idea is that VMT reduction is good for a whole lot of different things. And so you can parameterize that in any different way that you want. And then right from the start, we're going to want to start thinking about our assessment metrics, because that's going to allow us to understand, you know, how successful this program is and how to iterate it going into the future. And then really, this is the most important point here, is that you want to really focus on inducing new purchases. Right. So if you're handing out money to people who were already planning on purchasing an e-bike, that's a waste of money for your program and doesn't actually net any positive gain. So it's really important that the programs are designed in a way that there is a focus on bringing new people into the e-bike market that may have not otherwise had access. And so an important part of that is identifying your target population. So it's totally acceptable to hand out money to the general public. It just may be less efficient than focusing your subsidy cash in some other way, you know, generally by handing out money to low-income folks for whom this large purchase price for these e-bikes might be more of a barrier. And so generally, right, this is going to need to be reflected again in those program goals and in the goals of the body that's administering this program. And this will vary largely, you know, program to program. But generally what we're seeing, you know, the best outcomes come when your target population is defined a little bit more narrowly. And the next step would be to define the types of bikes to be included. And, you know, here the big idea is that the more bikes you provide, the more choice your consumers will have, and the better off everyone will be, right? Because you're going to provide for a wider variety of use cases. If you include cargo bikes specifically, right, you're catching a much larger portion of the market and allowing more and more people to replace their vehicle trips with an e-bike, which is the ultimate goal here. And then another important consideration here is to to think about where people are going to pick up these bikes. And of course, you want to give priority to your local retailers, because keeping money in your local system is the best way to go about it, especially if you're, you know, a local or municipal government here. But also because those local bike shops are going to allow participants to have a place where they can easily go to have reliable service, which is maybe more difficult on bikes that they would purchase online. Having some level of support and community on that is really great. Next step here would be to select some incentive amounts. And, you know, like I said, you know, having preferential benefits for people at lower incomes is a really effective way to go about this. And so we've heard this called a targeted universalism approach. This was coined by the folks running a program up in Saanich in BC. And the idea here, right, is that the lower your income is, the more benefit you get, with the idea being that this is going to be the most efficient way to incentivize new purchases. Another way that you can go about incentive setting here is doing a local price sensitivity survey. So, you know, literally asking your constituents how much money it would take to convince them. And this is how Corvallis, Oregon went about their program. And it seems to be a really effective way. Of course, you know, we're really interested in minimizing barriers to participants, and a flat rebate is a really great way to go about that, just because this is a much more equitable way to go ahead and to distribute those funds. Because, you know, if I'm more able to put in extra cash to buy a bike up front than other people, it's not fair that I should receive more of a rebate, right? So the flat rebate amount means that everyone's on a level playing field for the amount that they get, regardless of the amount that they're putting into the bike themselves. And then monetizing externalities is another way that you can these incentive amounts. So, you know, particular the program in one of the programs in Vermont did some math and figured out that through the life of an e-bike, right, it's going to offset somewhere on the order of $300 of greenhouse gas fees that the power district would have been assessed. And so the savings were passed on to the constituents there in the form of a $200 incentive. But there's a number of other different ways that a number of other different externalities that could be monetized to parameterize some level of incentive setting. And an interesting piece that, you know, you can read more about in the white paper here when it comes out is that, you know, there's been some research saying that basically no matter what the incentive level is set to, you know, up to $1,500 or so, bike shop revenues will outpace that incentive dollar. So if you're a bike shop, right, you can rest assured that your profit margin will be able to compensate for whatever incentives you're giving out. And so another way that we're looking to lower barriers for participation is by giving point of purchase rebates rather than mail-in rebates after the fact. And this is so that participants don't need to carry any of that liability themselves. Because if you're asking a participant, right, to carry the value of a $1,000 incentive, that may be the deciding factor for them. They're waiting for their next paycheck to come in, and that's too much of a burden. One of the really easy ways to create some more access here is to give that money up front, you know, either in the form of a rebate discount or through a sales tax waiver. And then strategic partners are going to be really key to success. So looking at community organizations, which, you know, can help both with outreach and education, as well as identification of need and challenge. One of the biggest things that to take away from this slide here is that you're really looking to get people on bikes. That seems to be one of the best ways to convince people that e-bikes are awesome, is just riding one. So if you can in any way through these partners facilitate demos, that'll be really, really powerful in helping people take the leap. And then we want to evaluate concerns, you know, any of those concerns for fraud or recreational use. This is a great time to do them rather than upfront. So question I get most often is, you know, which programs are the best? So we've got one right at home here in Corvallis, Oregon, who's offering a $1,200 flat value incentive up to $200 less than the purchase price, which is distributed at the point of purchase, so as a discount. And Corvallis is the only program that I know of that administered a price sensitivity survey to their local constituents. You know, like I said, literally ask them how much money they need to buy an e-bike, and then give them that much money. They used local income statistics to restrict their program to certain income levels. As far as I know, they're the only program that is doing so on an honor basis. And then Denver, whose program just started, I believe, on Friday, they're the only one who's providing preferential benefit for cargo bikes, as well as a really clear definition of what a cargo bike is. So what's next? Like I said, we're putting out a white paper with all the results that I just presented here and a more nuanced discussion of those purchase incentive programs and considerations for their design. And then the next step is a national state of preference survey. So we're doing something similar to what Corvallis has done, figuring out how much money people actually need to make the decision to buy a bike. We're really just kind of interested in all the different factors that might go into designing that rebate level to make it most effective for folks. Thanks for having me.
And that was Cameron Bennett talking about his research on e-bikes. You're listening to The Bike Show. My name is Alon Rab, and I would like to thank our guests, Karim Kamara, Mike Cobb, and Cameron Bennett, my co-host, Nedra Deadweiler, and to you, our listeners. See you at some Pedalpalooza Bike Summer events.
KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 31 de mayo del 2022.